This is a presentation to the Rocky Mountain Academy of Occupational Environmental Medicine in 2013, using psychological evaluations to improve patient care and outcomes. I want to begin by talking about managing patients with chronic pain and common problems that we all run into. Have you ever said this to a patient? You know, all your tests have come back negative, and there is really no clear objective reason why you should be feeling so much pain. So how well does that go over? How often do patients say, "Thank you, doctor. That clears that up. I'll just go back to work now, and you can cancel that prescription for opioids." Actually, you may hear something more like this. "You don't believe my pain is real, do you? My pain is not in my head. Something must be wrong or I wouldn't feel this way." They might even go on to say something else, like, "If you can't explain why I have pain, is there a smarter physician somewhere that you could refer me to who might be able to figure it out?" There's a great quote I'd like to share with you. "To have great pain is to have certainty. To hear that another has pain is to have doubt." I think that pretty well captures it. Pain is a subjective phenomenon. We have to rely on what people say to us in order to assess it. If you have pain yourself, it's pretty clear. But one of your patients says, "I have pain, I need opioids," it does give rise to questions in the back of your mind. So how do we assess patients with chronic pain? What have we learned from science over the years? I'd like to spend a little time briefly reviewing what we know about pain, and then to go on and apply this to particular cases. To begin with, there is, of course, the traditional biomedical view of pain. It begins with the assumption that physical health and mental health are separate and distinct, and that pain is either real and biological or not real and in your head. So for people who have not real pain, it's either because they're lying about or malingering, or they are imagining the pain, and it has to do with some severe kind of Freudian psychopathology. More simply stated, when we say that the pain is in your head means you're either malingering or there's psychopathology, it means you're either a crook or a crock. However, decades of research have pretty much proven that this view of pain is wrong. So what is the nature of pain? Often in clinical settings, we talk about pain as if it was one thing, when actually that's not the case. And I want to just very briefly talk about pain physiology as just a brief refresher. I assume most of you know this already, but I just want to be fresh in your minds as we start to apply this knowledge to more practical situations. As you know, a nociceptor is a pain sensory receptor, and they come in various types. There can be mechanosensitive receptors that respond to pinching or cutting, thermosensitive, they're responsive to heat or cold, chemosensitive, they're responsive to like chemical burns or like a bee sting, polymodal sensors, and also what are called sleeping sensors, which are activated by inflammation, but otherwise maybe don't do anything. So again, we don't have a single type of pain sensor. Actually, there are a number of types of pain sensors, which all do something different, but which we collectively refer to as pain. There are also two parallel pain sensory systems. There's what's called first pain, which explains acute pain, and second pain, which explains chronic pain. These are characterized by different types of sensors and also different types of nerve fibers, with first pain using A-delta nerve fibers and chronic pain utilizing C nerve fibers, with the difference being the C nerve fibers are not myelinated. The acute pain sensory system, or first pain, it's called first pain, fast pain sometimes, because the signals travel 100 miles an hour about, and they get to the brain first. This is a high-speed conduit of information, and it produces a sharp, localized sensation, like if you got stuck with a needle. You could pretty much say exactly when you got stuck, when the pain started, where it was, and when the pain stopped. These pain signals go to the cerebral cortex, to the sensory motor cortex, and is associated with a withdrawal reflex. You touch a hot burner, you go ouch, and you pull your hand back. So it's a very rapid reflexive process. In contrast, we have the chronic sensory system, also known as second pain. It arrives in the brain second. If a person is about 6 feet tall, you step on a needle, it may take 3 seconds for the slow pain to get to your brain. It travels that slowly. So this is a low-speed conduit, and it's routed differently. As opposed to going to the cerebral cortex, it goes through the arousal center and the emotion centers of the brain, the reticular system and the limbic system. And chronic pain produces a dull, diffuse ache, which is hard to characterize. So I want to talk about some riddles now as we think about this, about the pain sensory system and paradoxes that it creates. Now here's the first question. Where is pain? That sounds like a dumb question, at least at first. But think about a case of a person with a traumatic amputation. Suppose a person has a traumatically amputated foot and says, "My missing foot hurts." So where is that pain? Is the pain in the foot? That's where you feel it, but there's no foot. Is the pain in the stump? Maybe the stump doesn't hurt. Is the pain in the brain? Does that mean it's all in his head? It's not real. So where is that pain? It's kind of hard to say. Now suppose you have another patient who complains of foot pain, but does have a foot. Where is that pain? Is that in the foot? Not really. It turns out that some of the same confusion still happens, and as we go, hopefully this will become clearer. Here's another riddle. How are color blindness, tinnitus, and chronic pain all alike? Any guesses? All of them are types of sensory disorders. With color blindness, you can't see something that is there. With tinnitus, you hear something that's not there. And with chronic pain, you feel pain even after the injury is healed. So all three can be thought of as types of sensory disorders. How are severe injuries and strobe lights alike? Now, if you could all look this way, please. Remember the movie Men in Black? Now, this may be too far for this to work, but maybe you get the idea that after you have a strobe light go off in your face, you see a blue dot. Maybe some of you are seeing that blue dot now, if you close your eyes. But you know that blue dot when you see it? It's all in your head. I mean, there is no blue dot floating around this room. It's in your head. And it's also real. So, how is that like pain? Well, chronic pain and strobe lights both produce this sensory after effect. And chronic pain can be like this sensory echo of the original injury, even after the injury is healed. It can come from sensory overload, and the nervous system just isn't recovering. And so your eyes get overloaded by the strobe and continue to sense something which is no longer there. So in that sense, the blue light is in your head. But it's still a real phenomena. Remember the movie Singing in the Rain? Some people call it the greatest musical of all time. And there's that classic scene of the guy dancing in the rain and just this euphoria. So here's a riddle. How does singing in the rain differ from Chinese water torture? Now, let me just say here at the start that the term Chinese water torture is a misnomer. It's not Chinese. It was invented in American prisons maybe 150 or so years ago as a means of punishment. And somehow it got that name, which stuck, but it's not really Chinese at all. It was a something that apparently came out of American prison. And here's an actual picture of Sing Sing Prison. I think it's around 1860. This guy who's strapped into this chair, he's handcuffed there. There's a big old barrel of water overhead, and just they let it drip on his head. So why isn't this prisoner just singing in the rain? Why isn't he saying, hey, I haven't showered in 6 months. This is great. So why can't we all just sing in the rain? Well, what makes the water punishment work when they did it years ago was, first of all, the context. You know, people are handcuffed in. We are doing this to you. You can't control it. The context makes it far more aversive. And then secondly, the length of time. A rain shower may just last for 10 minutes or so, but the water punishment could go on for days or weeks or longer. Let's talk about that effect of time span. There's this phenomenon called TSSP, which stands for temporal summation of second pain. Now, unlike first pain, second pain has a cumulative effect, the temporal summation of second pain. It adds up over time. And this produces a phenomenon called windup. So it winds up the central nervous system, particularly in the spine, and that sensitizes the nociceptors. And this is part of the process of central sensitization. The long-term effect winds up the spine. What happens in the brain now? Over the course of time, the perception of pain is like the perception of the dropping water in the water punishment. At some point in chronic pain, people say, I am so sick of this pain. I hate it. And at that point, they're no longer feeling the pain in that moment. They're feeling all the pain, and that's a memory process. And sure enough, if we look at fMRI studies of the brain, what we see is that in patients with chronic pain, the pain is being processed not by the sensory parts of the brain, but rather primarily by the memory center and the emotion centers of the brain. So it's no longer a sensory process. So think about it. When your patient says, my pain never changes. Bingo. That's exactly true. Because it's a memory process. It's not a sensory process. But patients don't realize that this has happened, that they're no longer feeling what they're feeling in the moment, but it's rather the memory part of their brain that's actually driving this. What they experience as pain is not this moment, but rather the cumulative effect. Like the blue dot, it's this after image from being overstimulated. Even after the strobe is gone, the blue dot persists, and even after the injury is healed, the pain persists. And they're not making it up, it's real. It can be incapacitating. You know, if you're in a dark room and a strobe goes off in your face, you've lost your night vision. It's in your head. I mean, your eyes aren't working right, but it's a sensory disorder. You can't see in the dark then. It is disabling. And chronic pain can also be disabling. Here's another question. Are you male or are you female? Think of the answer. Now, let me ask you this. How many of you checked? Show of hands. How many of you did this from memory? So that's sensory versus memory. You did memory. Maybe you didn't think about that, but you did use memory to answer that question. If you ask a patient with chronic pain, what's your pain level? 10. Did you check or did you do that from memory? Often they don't check. They do it from memory because they know what their pain is. Just like you know your gender, they know what their pain is. They don't have to check. They know. And again, without realizing it, it's gone from a sensory process to memory. Let's talk about some other strange findings about pain, which I also think are really intriguing and interesting. First of all, there's a part of the brain. You can see there it's in the blue, the anterior cingulate cortex, which is most closely associated with the experience of pain. And if a person is in physical pain and fMRIs, this part of the brain lights up. But now, interestingly, social pain produces the same effect as does seeing a loved one in pain or imagining pain, and also things like cognitive catastrophizing. All these things light up the pain center of the brain. So under fMRI, it's next to impossible to distinguish physical pain from social pain or seeing other people in pain. What we found is overall, the brain was not designed to distinguish strong physical pain from strong emotional pain. They get blurred together. Here's an interesting finding. Swearing reduces pain. Well, actually, swearing tends to reduce first pain. You know, you hit your thumb with a hammer, hurts, you go, damn it! You feel a little stronger. You know, it helps you to cope with the pain. But then swearing in chronic pain tends to make it worse. So a second pain, which goes through the emotion center, anger tends to make it worse. First pain, it's different. Talk therapy reduces pain too. We think of opioids as pain relievers, but opioids can cause pain. You know, think of the movie where you have some heroin addict going cold turkey and going through terrible pain. That's opioid-induced pain. Sometimes we end up using opioids to treat opioid withdrawal pain. And so we have this infinite loop where we're using opioids to treat opioid pain. Now, interestingly, sometimes placebos can actually reduce nociception. Not just trick the person into thinking it's different, but actually make nociceptors work differently. I think we all know that some antidepressants are powerful analgesics. Interestingly, one study found that Tylenol has some ability to reduce emotional pain. Again, showing that this distinction between physical and emotional pain is a false dichotomy. Pain has strange effects. Chronic pain is associated with a shrinkage of the brain. Brains appear 10 or 20 years older. Pain can also cause arthritis. Now, this is not the other way around. Arthritis causes pain, but pain can cause arthritis. Studies have also shown that chronic pain tends to rewire the brain. Now, this is a study of CRPS showing how patients' brains were rewired, as shown by the illustrated lines here, which connects the memory center with the emotion center, and that rewiring may reverse with effective pain treatment. So let's put it all together. The inputs are first pain and second pain, and those travel up to the brain in different paths, with first pain arriving first in the sensorimotor cortex and producing a withdrawal reflex, but second pain traveling through the arousal and emotion centers in the brainstem and limbic system. And the experience of pain draws the person's attention and gives rise to cognitive processes in the frontal lobes about what does this mean? And the brain can respond by increasing muscle tension, bracing oneself, and by descending neural inhibition, saying, yeah, I don't need to think about this pain, it doesn't worry me so much, versus wind up. And all of this together gets processed in the pain center. So where is pain? Pain is this complex perceptual phenomena that you can't really say, well, it's in one place, like it's in the foot or in the spine. It's distributed across a bunch of different systems. Overall, I think it's fair to say that nociception does not become pain until the brain says so. In the biomedical model, pain was like a one-way phenomenon, that pain happens in the foot, travels up the, you know, up or travels through the nervous system to the brain where it presents itself. But in truth, in the pain sensory system, information is going both ways. It is as much an efferent process as an afferent neural process. And pain is influenced by not just the neural stimulation, but also by cognition, affect, and arousal. So when your patient says, why can't somebody find out what is wrong with me and fix it? They'll say, why can't you just cut the pain out of me? I think we now can say that, well, we do know what's wrong. You have a pain disorder. And there are ways of treating it, but it's not surgery. So how do we assess this? And so this brings us to the topic of the value of psychological assessments. How good are psychological tests? There was a massive review study about a decade ago, which reviewed 125 meta-analyses, just a huge study. And what they were doing is comparing the scientific validity of psychological tests as opposed to medical tests. And what they found was that, as a general rule of thumb, the scientific ability of psychological tests to diagnose and predict outcome is roughly equivalent to the ability of medical tests to diagnose and predict outcome. In some cases, better or worse, you know, but like psychological tests versus MRIs, often the psych tests are better predictors of lumbar surgical outcome than MRIs are. So what is psychometrics? Psychometrics sounds like some variation of voodoo, but it's actually something we encounter every day. You know, you cannot watch an episode of the news without somebody citing a poll that says, today a poll found that 52% of Americans, blah, 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 blah. And you know, these surveys are pretty accurate. They're scientific surveys, and the science is psychometrics. Now, where these scientific polls look at the sentiments of a population, psychological tests use the same science, but one person at a time, trying to predict what is this person thinking and feeling, and what makes this person tick. Now, if you look at guidelines, whether it's Colorado guidelines, ACOM guidelines, ODG guidelines, or others, there are certain psychological tests that are widely used. There are some tests that are just general measures of psychopathology. You know, it's their mental health tests. The MMPI, the new MMPI-2RF, are some of the most commonly known tests, but they're measuring psychopathology. There's the MCMI-3 and PAI. Those are the most common measures of psychopathology. On the other hand, there are biopsychosocial tests. These are psychological tests designed not for psychiatric patients, but for medical patients. And here there's BHI-2, MBMD, BBHI-2, and P3. Now, I have a conflict of interest because I'm an author of two of these tests, the BHI-2 and BBHI-2, and I'll be talking about the BHI-2 some, and my reason for this is that it's the only one of these tests that was really designed for the workers' compensation system. And so I think the results might be more relevant to you. But just so you know, I do have my biases. So I want to switch now to some of my own research and some illustrated case histories. Now, the BHI-2 is a battery for health improvement, too. It's a biopsychosocial test. It takes about a half hour to administer. It's often used for pre-surgical psych evals, pre-treatment psych evals. It looks at the interaction of psychological and physical symptoms. Now, this was co-authored by myself and by Mark DeSorbio, a neuropsychologist, who my partner who's in the audience here today. When psychological tests are developed, there are certain standards. Just like with the FDA, a medication needs to show that it's safe and effective. For a psychological test, it needs to be standardized and be valid and reliable. Valid mean it measures what it's supposed to measure, and reliable mean that you can give it twice and get the same results. As part of the validation of the BHI-2, we performed about 2,500 psych evals at 106 sites in 36 U.S. states. Now, not just, we didn't actually do any of it, but it was all done by various proctors who were trained around the country. And this enabled us to establish two norm groups, the average American and the average American patient, just as norm groups for what does the average person look like. And so with a psychological test, just like you give a CBC, and you get all these readings for, you know, blood glucose and, you know, sodium levels and so on, and you have an average range in the person who's high or low. And in a similar fashion with the psychological test, with the BHI, you have this average range for scores, and the scores can be either high or low. If they're in the gray range, that's average. If they're above or below that, that's high or low, respectively. And you can see over here on the side, you have a rating of, you know, average or whatever, and the percentile rank. So, let's talk about case history. You have a male work comp patient with severe pain. Not responding to treatment, overusing opioids. Will surgery help this patient? Here are the results. We can see on the test results that, first of all, the patient is really high on pain complaints, which means severe diffuse pain. Now let's look closer at the pain findings, and what we see is it asks about pain in 10 different body areas, and the patient has pain in 9 out of 10 body areas, with a pain of 10 in 3 body areas. A person reports low back pain, you know, that's the diagnosis, and a person has a 10 in their low back and an 8 in their legs, but also has a 10 of headache and chest pain of a 10, abdominal pain of an 8. So you can see over here in the blue, this is the average of a national sample of patients in the same diagnostic category, and this patient's pain is way higher. Now, you know the old saying about some patients have lumbago. That has to be distinguished from a Winnebago, because Winnebago travels all over your body. This patient has gone from lumbago to Winnebago. It's got pain every place. Now, what's more important is we look at the maximum tolerable pain. We ask, so how much pain can you tolerate and still work? They say, zero. This person has pain in 9 out of 10 body areas, pain of 10 in 3 body areas. How much pain can you work with? Has to get to zero. Now, the average American healthy person has more pain than that. So, what are the odds of making this person totally pain-free? I would say dismal. But this person is saying, unless you do, I can't work. Let's go back to the overall profile. We can see that this patient is also highly anxious, with anxiety being at the 99th percentile compared to other patients, and is also very high in muscular bracing, or the tendency to respond with physical tightness. And one of the explanations for the diffuse pain is this person is just chronically bracing their muscles all over their body, and we have diffuse muscle contraction pain. Now the patient also is very high in substance abuse. So the patient who has a history of chemical dependency, is a severe pain, is abusing opioids, and so is probably using opioids to treat anxiety as well as pain. And last we see down here as in conflict with the physician, you know, over opioids. So the question is, will surgery fix this? You know, this person would be at high risk for being unhappy with surgery, because, you know, surgery doesn't fix addiction, doesn't change the muscular bracing, a psychophysiological response, and so what do? You have widespread pain with poor pain tolerance. There's pain management therapy, extreme anxiety, high depression. You can treat that with medication and cognitive therapy. Very high bracing response. Treat that with relaxation train, maybe massage, substance abuse to treat anxiety. You have to use an opioid contract and also treat any addiction that's present. I mean, too often patients like this might get surgery, but this is a patient who has a very high risk for being dissatisfied afterwards, because surgery does not fix these problems. Second case history, middle-aged woman, back injury, excessive disability, and has been chronically non-compliant with physical therapy. What do we see here? First of all, we see that in functional complaints, a measure of self-perceptions of disability, this patient's at the 99th percentile in terms of self-perception of disability. But also, this is associated with high somatic complaints. This person is somatically extremely distressed. You know, this is the person who has not just pain symptoms, but feels exhausted, can't sleep, jittery, loss of libido, loss of appetite. And there are more distress symptoms, interestingly, than pain symptoms, because the pain symptoms are in the normal range. And this patient is also very depressed. And down here at the bottom is a really interesting finding. It's called survivor of violence. This patient is reporting a history of being abused in childhood and also being in abusive relationships as an adult. It turns out that this woman was molested as a child, has seen a male physical therapist, and just can't stand to have him touch her. She feels really vulnerable. She was referred to a surgeon for a rectal examination, refused it. She said that I would rather be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life than to undergo a rectal exam. Now, in this case, what we did is we found a female physical therapist and also a female surgeon to do the examination. The patient was so distressed that she was having some suicidal ideation, so she needed treatment for her depression and needed to be monitored for her safety. And for somatic distress, general stress management training. Again, knowing what made the person tick helps you know what to do. Case history number 3. A prison guard injured during a training exercise. He's being considered for a cervical fusion. He's angry and threatening and demands to be fixed. In this case, we have a patient who, again, has very high pain complaints and somatic complaints. But in this case, is very high in hostility. This is a very angry, belligerent person. And look down here further, has a high level of borderline personality symptoms and a high level of chronic maladjustment. Now, this means the person has a long history of impulsive, dysfunctional behavior. And lastly, has a history of reports a very high level of job dissatisfaction. Now, when we are validating this test, in our national sample, we identified 70 patients who were thinking about suing their physician and 70 patients who were thinking about killing their physician. Now, this guy's profile is very similar to the profiles of those groups, and especially of the violent group, with the exception that he's not mad at his physician, at least yet, but he is mad at his boss. So this is a person who is potentially dangerous. So this is a patient who is hostile, potentially dangerous, and so you need to monitor the patient for safety, long history of maladjustment, you need to treat the depression and anger with medications and cognitive therapy, try pain management treatment, and you should really delay any elective surgeries until you know the person isn't dangerous to self or others. Let's think about conceptualizing causality in cases like this. So how did this happen? On one hand, this patient has a number of predisposing causes. The patient had anatomically mild degenerative disc disease. There was also psychologically a history of maladjustment and anger. And the patient was also impulsive and a risk taker. And all of those are risk factors for an injury. And so the patient has a slip and fall at work. The first category here are predisposing causes. Then you have a precipitating cause, a slip and fall. So now the patient is in treatment. What prevents the patient from getting better? And you have sustaining causes. You had a herniated cervical disc. Okay, that's an ongoing pain generator. You also have hostility, depression, and dysfunction. And the patient hates a job, abusing opioids, and is litigious. And so all of these factors on the right are keeping the patient from recovering. Now, some of these problems are medical. Some of them are not. So how do you intervene? Just being able to know what's going on gives you a fighting chance to come up with an effective treatment plan. So sometimes I think about apportionment as being just purely a legal question, but often it's an important treatment question as well. Why is a person feeling this way? And to the extent we can better understand the causality in the case, we have a better idea about what to do. So for high-risk patients, what do? You just say you get no treatment? No, what we found for these high-risk patients that they're candidates for behavioral treatments. If you look at large, well-controlled studies of psychological treatments versus surgical treatments for people with back pain, turns out they're about equally effective. Now, obviously, there are cases where a person has Kawakana syndrome and you do surgery today if you can. But in many cases with persons with just complaint of pain, psychological treatments like pain management, cognitive treatments, stress management, can be as effective as surgical treatments for select patients. And also, importantly, when you cost it out, the surgery works out to be like about 168 times more expensive than the psych treatments. So it's worth trying the psych treatments first. Now, because of all the things I'm talking about here, treatment guidelines for pain and injury widely endorse psychological assessments and treatments. And this is true for the Colorado guidelines, for ACOM, and for ODG as well. But is this all just pie in the sky, or does it work? We decided to test that hypothesis. Now, for a while, I've been working with Catherine Miller and others from the Colorado Division of Work Comp to try to assess the effect of the Colorado treatment guidelines. Now, in 1992, you may not know this, Colorado passed a law which helped to generate these comprehensive treatment guidelines, and no other state did this. So what we did is we looked at medical inflation, Colorado versus the country over 15 years, with Colorado being the one state to have developed its own unique guidelines to see what the effects were. So Colorado legally mandated a biopsychosocial model. Other states did not. So we were able to look at the results of about 29 million patients over 15 years, looking at mean medical cost per case. And this study was just published a few months ago. And these are the results. Here is medical inflation in medical costs per case and workers' compensation. And you can see the blue line is the nation, the red line, Colorado. Over 15 years, there was a 202% inflation in the nation compared to Colorado, 68%. So Colorado's inflation was only about a third of the nation. And if you can look at over the last several years, there was a virtual absence of medical inflation, which is quite unusual. Next, we can look at indemnity costs. What are the costs of disability? Over 15 years, the nation, 109%. In 15 years in Colorado, 28%. So here it's over a 3-to-1 advantage for Colorado. How much did this save? The estimates were that in 2007 alone, this saved the Colorado work comp system about $859 million. So how does this save the money? Is it just by denying care, denying surgery? You know, the guidelines were not about denial of care. They were about what is the best care. And in many cases for these patients, surgery is not the best care. If somebody is addicted to opioids, surgery is not the best care for helping them get off. Now, I'm going to say something that will sound totally psychotic, but I want you to bear with me. Mark DeSorbio and I hypothesized in one of our recent articles that the goal of a lot of orthopedic surgeries is to change verbal behavior. Now, that sounds kind of crazy, but think about it. If I have a bulging disc, and I go to my doctor, and he says, "How do you feel?" And I say, "I feel great." Nobody's going to cut on me. But if I tell the physician, "I am in agony. I need more opioids. I can't work. I can't do anything. You got to help me." Now, that could tip me over to where I'd be given a surgical referral, and somebody might be willing to cut on me. And if they did, what's the goal of that treatment? Of the surgery, it's to make me say something different, to make me say, "Thanks, doc, the pain is gone. Thanks, doc, I don't need opioids. Thanks, doc, I can go back to work now." Now, surgery does a great job at reducing a compound fracture. But when it comes to doing other things, like changing verbal behavior, curing addiction, depression, somatization, or making a person want to go back to work, surgery can be pretty iffy. And if you're looking for a behavioral outcome, a behavioral treatment might well work better. So, just practically, when should you refer a patient for a psychological evaluation? According to the Colorado guidelines, there are a number of reasons. All patients with chronic pain, prior to biofeedback, CBT or interdisciplinary treatment, before a lumbar fusion or spinal cord stimulator, artificial disc, and other procedures like rhizotomy or IDET. If there's been more than 8 weeks of treatment and there's no progress and there's no clear reason why. And also before discograms, because you know with discograms, it depends on what a person says. So those are all the situations that the guidelines say you should refer for some kind of psychological assessment. Then here, the guidelines in different situations may recommend or sometimes require it, so you should be aware of that. How do you make a referral for a psych eval? Now, if you use the biomedical model, it comes out like this. There's nothing physically wrong with you. The pain is all in your head. You need to see a psychologist. If you do that, the patient will be angry at you, and the patient will be angry at me. This makes a psychologist's job really hard. In contrast, there is a different way that's more consistent with the evidence, with the science of pain, and in a more helpful way, which is this. You tell your patient, my goal is to address how you are doing both physically and emotionally. Having you see a psychologist will help me understand you better and offer you better care. And you do it that way, the patient goes, geez, my doctor cares about me. In conclusion, psychological services are now accepted as an integral part of the assessment and treatment of pain conditions. Utilizing these assessments and the biopsychosocial model is associated both with better care and with controlled costs. Thank you.